ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Main engine start.
I remember the day so clearly.
One liftoff.
Roger, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
I ran outside as fast as I could and I looked up in the sky.
Couldn't believe it. It had exploded. I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
We're going to tell you the story of Challenger.
Challenger Legacy. Search for Science Friction wherever you get your podcasts.
Or on the ABC Listen app.
Well, if he's looking for a way to mortally wound the NATO alliance, Donald Trump may yet achieve just that in Greenland.
He can't leave it alone, Geraldine. He's not interested in negotiation. Now he's threatening tariffs against European powers who stand in his way, insisting that the US take ownership of Greenland and all its icy real estate.
Yes, look, maybe he's not so interested in peace after all. This is becoming, truly, a full-blown European-American crisis.
I'm Latika Burke in London.
And I'm Geraldine Duke. Welcome to this episode of our new daily global roaming, all about what some are calling the transatlantic relationship's worst week. Really, Latika, if you'd written the script for a political comedy or a farce a few years ago, it might have had a great plot outline, such as we're watching. You know, my motto this year is to try not to become as passionate as I easily get, to try to sort of keep a calm tone just because everything around seems so really quite sort of turbulent and highly emotional. But dear, oh dear, it is not easy to stay sort of cool, is it, in the wake of what's been happening in the last few days?
And Geraldine, fun fact, it's only been 1 year since President Trump was inaugurated, so we've got 3 more years of this. Look, wherever this goes next, I mean, it is certainly true to say I think we're at the most serious crisis point in the transatlantic relationship, certainly since Suez. And the mood of the European leadership, it's tense. Remember Mark Rutte, NATO's Secretary General, only last month declared Europe must be ready for the scale of war our grandparents or great-grandparents endured.
Conflicts are no longer fought at arm's length. Conflict is at our door. Russia has brought war back to Europe, and we must be prepared for the scale of war our grandparents and great-grandparents endured.
Now, he was referencing there, Geraldine, the threat of Russia, not from the US. But what we see emerge this year is that it's all now playing into the same sense of insecurity. And as the new boss of MI6 says, Europe is living in a space between peace and war.
Yes, and I think that that must be, for Europeans, an extraordinary, like the European citizenry who are receiving all this material now, you know, they know about the NATO, something that has been in existence since 1949 with 32 member states, 30 in Europe, 2 in North America, that's the US and Canada, knowing that there was something called Article 5, an attack against one is an attack on all, that was a system of collective security that really has had its strains. And since the fall of the Soviet Union in the 90s, it sort of changed, really. There was a sense that you could reduce your military spending. And then that all changed again, one could argue, with February 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine. And suddenly you had places like Finland and Sweden, who'd always stayed out and been neutral, deciding to join NATO because they were, frankly, so frightened. So here we are now with Europe that still doesn't have a, like, they couldn't defend themselves at the moment, but they definitely have been seen to be, with the help of the United States, this vanguard against horror. I want you to listen, if you would, to a fabulous clip from Winston Churchill in 1943, so when the war was still not won, where he starts to foreshadow the need for new post-war institutions.
We have learned from hard experience that stronger, more efficient, more rigorous world institutions must be created to preserve peace and to forestall the causes of future wars.
So as he says, without institutions that work, you've got anarchy. And I wonder, Latika, if that is starting to dawn on Europeans who really haven't practiced this particular muscle for a long, long time.
And really, Geraldine, a question that does need to be asked is NATO still fit for purpose in 2026? And is it fit for purpose with an administration like the Trump one in the White House?
Well, now, look, I think that it probably is time for us to introduce our expert guest. She's someone you know well, Latika, so why don't you do the honours?
Well, it is a great honour to introduce and welcome Oana Lungescu to Global Roaming. I've known her for several years. She is an absolute powerhouse in European security. She is known to everybody in Brussels and particularly anyone to do with NATO. She first covered the organisation as a journalist for the BBC World Service. She's now a distinguished fellow at RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute, a think tank here in London. And she's just back to Brussels after a lightning visit in Vilnius, Lithuania. So it was great to steal some of her time for Global Roaming. Here she is now.
Oana Lungescu, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you so much for having me.
And look, the big question to start, and we can work back afterwards, do you think NATO can survive all this? What's your instinct?
I think it can, but this is a really dangerous moment, perhaps like we haven't seen before in a 77-year history, which has seen a lot of crises, from the Suez crisis back in 1956 to France walking out of NATO's military integrated command in 1966, to the Iraq war, and of course when Trump threatened to walk out of NATO if allies didn't pay more. But this really feels very different. We've seen this gradual erosion of trust. So it's not just about transactionalism, it's about threats. And that is very serious.
And where would you put the greatest danger? What do you isolate as the greatest threat now?
I think there's a big danger of distraction in the sense that we're not focusing on the real threats, which are Russia's war in Ukraine and the danger that Russia poses to Europe, the challenges of China, and the need to defend ourselves. So I think there is a threat of a sort of displacement activity. It's a distraction from the real threats, whereas Greenland is not a threat. Greenland is an opportunity for allies to cooperate, to step up on Arctic security, which everybody realizes is important to all allies.
But Oana, is the United States now a threat? And I can't believe I can even phrase that question, but is the threat now the United States? And does NATO even have a plan for NATO states attacking each other?
No, that's not what NATO was set up for. NATO was set up to make sure that allies defend each other against an external threat. So it's not been set up to deal with internal threats. The closest we came to something like this was the repeated military tension between Greece and Turkey. But this is of a very different magnitude, because this is the biggest ally in NATO, the indispensable ally in NATO. So that's why, of course, this is a moment of danger and of concern.
If we walk back to how this latest tension erupted, it seems to have been the deployment of just a handful of troops by a few NATO allies to Greenland. On paper, that is or was designed to show America that those countries were capable of stepping up to the security challenges that Greenland presents. This seems to have been read very differently in the United States. Was that a mistake, Oana?
I don't think so. I think it actually started before. It started during President Trump's first term, when he first suggested he wanted to buy Greenland. And then there was a sort of disbelief and sort of nervous laughter. And then it sort of went away. And then we saw very recently, after the U.S. intervention in Venezuela, that the issue of Greenland came up again. And clearly, NATO allies agree that security in the high north and security in Greenland is important, that geopolitical tensions are growing just as the ice cap is melting. So I think the message that Denmark and other NATO allies wanted to send through this exercise was that, yes, Europeans do take security in the high north seriously, and they're doing something about it. So this was not supposed to be a tripwire against an American invasion, as some suggested, because obviously that would not be a serious proposition. It was designed to show that European allies are adapting to the demands of President Trump, that they understand the need to do something about them. So it was just the opposite of how this was interpreted in Washington.
Well, it would appear to the outside observer in Australia, those people turning up in Greenland looked like the Europeans showing that they could collaborate and could come to a definite decision. Maybe, as you say, it's being read differently in Washington. But, I mean, we're also hearing about the sort of disappointment that the US president felt in not being awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. This message that he sent to the Norwegian Prime Minister, which honestly, I thought was a joke when I first read it, and now it is real, where he actually says, "Dear Jonas, considering your country decided not to give me the Nobel Peace Prize for having stopped 8 wars, I no longer feel an obligation to think purely of peace." Now, this is a very different sort of diplomacy than required now, it would seem, to get around these sorts of, what are they, hurt feelings?
It's hard to say. As you say, Geraldine, it's a rather extraordinary message, making the connection between the Nobel Peace Prize, which is awarded by an independent committee in Norway, and Denmark and Greenland, which have nothing to do with the Nobel Peace Prize. So it's very hard to read what this is all about. But I think whatever is in President Trump's mind, the reaction of the Europeans has been to try to stay calm, to stick together, which I think is very important, to push back in terms of the threat of tariffs, and also to think about how they can step up when it comes to their security, because clearly this is a moment where they need to invest much more in their defense and much more urgently, especially with the sort of tensions that we see now within the transatlantic alliance.
Owana, how much damage do you think has been done to NATO's inherent principle, Article 5?
Well, Article 5, of course, has at its core the principle all for one and one for all. What we're seeing now is one, the United States threatening not just Denmark, but also 7 other allies, which have taken part in some way in this most recent exercise, with punitive tariffs increasing. So 10% as of the 1st of February and 25% as of June, if the situation isn't solved. That clearly goes against the very notion of solidarity and NATO unity, which also is its ultimate deterrence against its adversaries. So one can only imagine that people like President Putin of Russia and President Xi of China must be rubbing their hands in glee and reaching for the popcorn, watching the spectacle of all these tensions between America and its oldest and closest allies.
You're just back from Vilnius, I think, Owana. The Baltics are very much on the front foot when it comes to active defence of their territory from the Russians. How are they reading this Greenland situation, do you judge?
Well, I think with a lot of nervousness, and it was noticeable that I was at the conference in Lithuania, as you said, where the focus was supposed to be very much on supporting Ukraine, making sure that we have a just and lasting peace. So that whole focus on supporting Ukraine was very much replaced by a rather anxious discussion over Greenland. So that shows you that they will do whatever they can to maintain NATO unity, because the reality is that Europeans do depend on the United States for their security, at least for the next 5 to 10 years, while they are stepping up on their rearmament programs. But they depend on the United States for key capabilities such as Patriots, air defense, and air and missile defense, the precision strikes, intelligence, and of course the nuclear umbrella. So there's a lot that the Europeans look to America for. But also at the same time, it's important to mention that the Americans also depend on the whole network of bases, military bases that they have in Europe, and the access to airfields and seaports. For instance, an operation such as Midnight Hammer against Iran would not have been possible without US military bases and the support of allies in Europe. The same thing, monitoring the threats coming, for instance, from Russian nuclear submarines from the Kola Peninsula heading towards the American mainland. Its countries and European allies such as Norway and Denmark and Iceland that are helping monitor those threats that could be heading towards the United States. So there is an interdependency between Europe and America, which unfortunately the current White House seems to ignore.
One of the big, I suppose, Trump whisperers to emerge on the European scene has been Mark Rutte. Certainly last year, he was credited with that very successful conference in The Hague, where all the NATO members agreed to sign up to higher defence spending to please Donald Trump. He's been very silent in the last few weeks, and there's been a bit of criticism about that. Do you think that the European flattery was a mistake when you contrast it with his silence now?
I don't think that what the European allies and Canada did at the NATO summit in The Hague last year was just to please Donald Trump, because the reality is that they need to invest 5%, at least 5% of GDP in their defense, and they need to do that to keep their people safe. So,
But Ioana, it is true and fair to say that it is only until Trump came along and put all the giant threats on the table that these allies did agree to sign up. They weren't doing it before him.
They started doing it in 2014 with President Obama, but of course, they were quite slow in fulfilling their pledge. On the other hand, Mark Rutte, I think, has his role as Secretary General of NATO is to keep the family together, to keep the transatlantic family together, the 32 allies, which clearly is a very tall order. It's not an easy job at all. So he has done it by keeping Donald Trump on side. And I think that remains his job. He can't criticize the President of the United States like, for instance, the leaders of the European Union can, because the United States is a big and important member of NATO. It's, if you wish, the majority stakeholder in the alliance.
And, you know, talking about the different attitudes across Europe that he's got to juggle, I mean, there are very different attitudes, aren't there, Ioana, to war preparedness. Places like the Baltics and Sweden and Finland and Poland, they're actually preparing their people, as we understand it, for war. You know, they run preparedness programs. I think there are 600,000 reservists in Finland who are really well trained. You know, they're not barbecue warriors. Now, how is this going to be coordinated, do you see?
Yeah, clearly these are very tough choices for every government in Europe, even though, exactly as you say, there are different threat assessments across Europe. It's very different if you go to Spain, where they're looking more to the Middle East, for instance, to the Mediterranean basin, or if you go to a place like Lithuania or Poland or Romania. So the other thing is that the sort of threats that Russia poses go below the threshold of open warfare, with things like arson, sabotage, espionage, assassinations.
This was a real feature of late last year, wasn't it? That sort of really ramped up.
Absolutely. Mm. Interference with critical undersea cables. So that's going on, and it's the biggest sort of campaign of sabotage and destabilization that Russia has been waging against Europe since the Cold War. And that is something that people are starting to understand, because cyber attacks or cutting electricity cables or internet cables really affects people's lives, which is why I think you see, including in Western Europe, a greater focus on security and defense.
Oana, one of the things that has really fascinated and I think excited me has been this emergence of the coalition of the willing to defend Ukraine, perhaps in the event of a ceasefire. That is not NATO, and it pulls in a lot of non-NATO partners, including Australia. Where do you see future coalitions or security architecture and the fit for purpose nature of NATO going forward?
Yeah, I think we're seeing a gradual shift to regional groupings, coalitions of the willing, including with partners, important partners such as Australia, which of course is a long-standing partner to NATO, based on working together in NATO on what we know as interoperability, but perhaps outside or only partly within NATO itself. And that's what we see with the coalition of the willing for Ukraine. And I think ultimately people will also be looking to Germany in particular, which will soon have the biggest conventional armed forces in Europe and is investing massively in defense. So we are seeing a very fast shifting landscape when it comes to security and defense, where certainly the Europeans need to take on much more of the burden of their own defense in whatever format.
And Oana, the EU states have scheduled this emergency summit for tomorrow, Thursday, your time. Is that performative, can I put it like that? Or is there some initiative that summit might yield that could change the way Washington is thinking?
I think it's a show of unity, and they will need to discuss the next steps when it comes to tariffs, depending on what signals they get from contacts with President Trump and his administration. They will want to show that they do have cards, as President Trump himself would say. And the Europeans, for instance, have the possibility of imposing retaliatory tariffs on things like orange juice and motorbikes, so quite wide-ranging. They also have the possibility of using what they call the trade bazooka, which is an instrument which has never been used before, an anti-coercion instrument, which was originally designed to deal with China and economic blackmail from China, which would be a much more radical step. But I think at this stage, at least, they will try to do whatever they can to have a calm dialogue with their American allies and to see how they can try to de-escalate this very serious crisis.
Oana Lungescu, thank you very much. I suspect we'll be talking to you again.
Thank you so much.
Well, Latika, I don't think I've done an interview with quite that degree of portent delivered quite so calmly for a long time. What was your main takeout from it?
Well, that is what you call European stoicism, I think, on fine display from Ioana. I thought there were a couple of key points in there. One was that word she used to describe the United States, indispensable. That is a word that's easy to miss, and we shouldn't miss it, because what she's really saying is there's no NATO if there's no United States. And that is an expression I hear a lot from my contacts in Europe. And that is really the guts of what's happening.
Yes, look, I did think the way she said they do have cards to play was quite clever. That could become an interesting diplomatic discussion. I also do think what I heard her say, we've got, in effect, she said, for 5 years, the Europeans need the Americans for all sorts of interoperability issues and so on. But that brings into account the question of politics in Europe. You know, there's that great line of Kissinger's big question that he allegedly put a few years back, if I want to talk to Europe, who do I call? Now, that's still pertinent, isn't it, Latika?
There's a great question and answer that John Bew, who was a former advisor in number 10 to 4 prime ministers here in the UK most recently. We went through a lot of them, so he managed to advise a fair few. But he gives this great quote, Geraldine, where he says that there are preparations quietly underway in Berlin, in Brussels, and Paris for life without the US security blanket. Now, whether we say that's the formal end of NATO, I think is almost irrelevant. The fact is, it's a race against time. So really the question about this these last few days and why you've seen this different level of reaction from Europe is that this is Trump accelerating what Europeans were already preparing for but aren't ready for now.
Yes, you do get the sense that. And of course, you know, your question about Rutte, you wonder whether Rutte is behind the scenes just frantically trying to work the diplomacy. I don't know. You're right. I haven't heard from Mark Rutte. We haven't heard, come to daddy.
He gave the most oblique tweet statement today just saying that he'll see Trump in Davos. I mean, thanks a lot. But Ioana was right, I thought, to kind of stress the difference there between European leaders. And Rutte, for all intents and purposes, his constituency is the United States. But it's a very difficult pill for so many Europeans to swallow to have seen the fawn offensive of 2025 materialize in a naked imperial threat on one of their own in 2026. They say, well, what do we need to demean ourselves for?
Yeah, no, I must say I've been wondering about that myself. Look, there's a little final sort of, epilogue here. Australia is about to appoint a new, very important job, our ambassador to Washington. We are an enhanced opportunities partner. We're a non-NATO, very significant partner. So I wonder, how we're going to position ourselves in Washington in the midst of all of this brew. Because, Kevin Rudd has resigned a year early. So that's another thing to look at. Just another one of the many aspects of these cards that will be played. We'd love to hear from you on what you think about NATO's future, not to mention what you think we should be talking about on the show, as there's a lot to talk about, and we'll be revisiting things too, possibly more than we did last year. Remember, every Monday, Hamish and I will be answering some of your questions from our quite breathtaking mailbag and hearing your feedback. So as always, I do invite you to write to us, global.roaming@abc.net.au. And Latika, you're the Knightley's writer at large in London, but we're so pleased to have you as a co-presenter on Global Roaming now, based as you are there, where I think there's going to be a lot of exciting developments this year.
What a joy to be here with you, Geraldine. I'll be back tomorrow with Kylie and another fresh episode at 11 a.m. or in your podcast feed.
Now, what have you got planned?
Well, we're heading to Cuba, so a bit of a change of scenery for me, possibly the next in line after Venezuela and Greenland for Donald Trump's attentions. How worried is Havana? It was closely allied with Maduro and has dealt for many years with high stakes from the US.
Lots to come. And our thanks to our producers, Kylie Morris and Shane Anderson. Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.